This is a Doxcast, not an Argon Soxcast, or a Bendis and Loxcast. Now I'm hungry. This is a Doxcast. It's a nerdy Toxcast. Discuss a Moxcast with Rich Early and friends.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another paradisical episode of the Doxcast. I am your co-host, Josh Frumbo, and with me, as always, is the thieving Rich Early. Rich, how are you doing this evening?
Today, Paradiso. Tomorrow, a parking lot.
That's right.
Yes. Don't it always seem to go? That's one of our themes on the show, is puns. So we're back with another exciting episode of the Docs.
I don't know if it's a theme so much as it's a punishment to our listeners.
Ooh, nice. But we're back with another exciting episode of the Docscast. We've got a comic guest with us again, but first we're going to get to everybody in the room. Brad Meixner is here as almost always.
That's me.
And Darren Gregson.
Hello.
And this is going to be fun because, so, when Darren and I travel the states going to conventions, the joke has become, from people who meet us, they say, where are you from, North Dakota? Well, Darren's from England, but, and so we now, we've got one friend who refers to his English accent as the North Dakota accent. So, anyway, so Darren, you want to introduce our guest today?
So this evening we are interviewing writer Ram V. Hello, Ram, how are you?
Hello, guys. I'm doing all right. How are you, Darren?
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Very good. We appreciate you coming on the show. It's actually, Ram V is based in England, so he's in London. So it's 7:20 here, so it's 1:20 a.m. in London. So we do appreciate you coming on the show at this time.
Darren's already been in bed for about 5 hours at that point. Right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I never got used to the time change.
So Ram and I just wanted to give you a quick introduction how I came across Ram's work, Ram V. Sorry, Image Book was launched last year. I think earlier this year, Paradiso, with artist Dev, and I started reading the book and I was really enjoying it. And Rich and I were going to go to the Comics Pro event in Portland, and I noticed that you were on the guest list,
yeah.
I was like, it's got to be the same guy. So I reached out to you on Twitter just to check, and you replied back, and it was you. And I was like, oh, cool. So I'm going to meet you, and I can get some books signed as well. So I was like, super excited about that. So, and I think I kind of saw you around, and I was a little bit nervous to speak to you other than like in an official capacity at your table. And then at the last day, I managed to kind of see you and get some books signed. That was great. So.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you did. It was my first time sort of at Comics Pro as well, and I just made it a point to sort of come out and meet the retailers because, you know, you've got to know the people that you're sending your books out to. I was kind of glad that you reached out on Twitter because I went, okay, at least I kind of know one person there.
So yeah, you were there as well. Was it Emerald City like the following week or something like that? You were,
yes. Yeah. So that happened kind of very strangely. I was originally talking to one of the retailers here in the UK, and they had mentioned that, you know, if you get the chance, you should go down to Comics Pro. And I found out that Image Expo was happening yeah. like a couple of days before, and then Emerald City was like a week after, and I went, well, I might as well just combine all three of those and do them all.
How did you find that experience?
Very good. I mean, I'd only done one... I'm relatively new to comics, so I'd only done one American convention before this, which was New York, and that's a very different convention compared to Emerald City, which felt a lot more sort of laid back, and people had more time, so you could, you know, really get to talk to a lot of the creators and people who were associated with comics there. So, very different experience. I quite enjoyed it.
Excellent. So,
yeah. And what's it like on that end? Like, we know what it's like as fans or retailers or whatever, but like, do you just hobnob with other creators and talk shop, or do you kind of just do your own thing, or like, how does that go?
I mean, to an extent, part of it's because you when you approach other creators, you're approaching them as a colleague, but also on some level as a fan, because you know of them because you love their work. It doesn't matter that you're also making comics, and so on that level it's pretty cool because there's a different kind of interaction when they realize that, oh, well, cool, you're making comics too, so you know what it's like. And there's that level of camaraderie, but there's also that sort of real excitement in meeting someone that whose work you've read before and kind of inspired you to start making your own books or something like that. So I guess there is a lot of commonality to being a fan as well. But I guess the one thing that I really enjoy approaching it as a creator is that the community feels so inviting. Like, it doesn't, you could meet someone, you know, who's been making comics for a decade compared to you who are making your first book, and it still felt to me like they were just as inviting and welcoming and excited about the work that you were doing too. So
excellent. But the question we always ask, we always like to ask this question, I mean, even of our customers, is what was your first comic and how did you get into reading comics?
So my first comic, and this is going to sound strange, is actually, I had a huge collection of the Phantom Lee Falk newspaper strips. And because I grew up in India, I didn't really have a lot of access to the Marvel DC stuff, but there was a local publisher who did reprints of a lot of these sort of Phantom, Mandrake, Flash Gordon comics. And so those were the comics that I really started off with. And I had these two giant sort of hardbound tomes that I had just bound all of my single issue comics together into these giant bricks. And that was really my first experience with comics. I used to love them. I used to enjoy them as a kid. But at some point, when I sort of probably became a teenager, my parents came in and said, oh, no, you can't be reading comics anymore. You have to read, like, serious books and prose. And they gave me all these novels. And they took away my comics, which was a very strange thing to do. And so I kind of grew up, you know, mostly through my teenage years, not reading any comics. And I was reading prose mostly at the time. Then I moved to the States when I was about 19 or 20 or so, and a friend of mine gifted to me for my birthday volume 1 of Sandman, and that kind of brought me back through this like insane wormhole back into really being in love with comics, because once I'd started that volume 1, I had to get the rest of it, and then I followed on reading all of Gaiman's work, then all of Moore's work, then all of Morrison's work, and it just wouldn't stop. And by the time I was done with that, I realized that I really want to do this. I really want to, you know, write comics. I'd been writing even before then as a kid and as a teenager, but I'd never really considered writing comics until I had that sort of experience. Like, I went away for a month, read all the comics ever, and then came back and went, yes, well, what, I need to do comics now.
What in particular called to you out of that stuff? Was there a, you know, was there a, something about the way that stories were told? Was there a theme? Was there a voice? You know, what was it that you know, lit your fire?
I guess just the ambition of a book like Sandman was one of the things that really struck me. That it was, because I'm also a science and engineering student, and you know, there's been the talk about that elusive theory of everything, that one theory that combines all theories and becomes like the be all and end all of science. And to me at the time, reading Gaiman Sandman felt kind of like that. It was trying to combine all stories into this one giant narrative, if you will, because it took from so many mythologies and so many references that it had within that book. And I really hadn't thought that you could do something like that with comics based on what I had read at the time. So that really struck me, and I think that was part of what really pulled me in. Once I discovered Alan Moore's work, I think it was just the voice. It was just the darkness of his writing, the willingness to take what were your childhood characters and put them through the ringer of hell that is just humanity, you know? So So I really enjoyed that. I think beyond that, it was just fascination with reading all these different crazy ideas. I always feel like comics have had crazier ideas, or almost they give you permission to do crazier ideas than a lot of other mediums do.
Yeah, I love that. I remember when Grant Morrison took over the X-Men, he said, you know, this is the industry's top-selling comic. Why shouldn't it be the industry's best comic? And so, like, that idea you're talking about of, like, wanting to aspire, wanting to be something more, something bigger. When I pick up comics often, and one of the things I often think to myself when I don't like a comic is, this comic is so small. This comic is so, you know, its own creative team has made it just seem inconsequential. They don't get it. They're not fired up about the creativity and what they could be doing. And that doesn't mean your story has to be gigantic, but often your idea does. And why aren't you aspiring if you're creating? So,
yeah, I mean, I agree. I've had these discussions with other creators around here, and I think we agree. And I think I might be paraphrasing someone here, but it's more interesting to watch someone ambitious fail flamboyantly than it is to watch someone, you know, work within themselves and do something really safe.
Brad and Josh, sorry, Darren and I are manipulating all the questions. So
I've been
far,
enjoying but, listening to him talk.
What have you noticed, you know, since you said you've read, you know, I guess we'd have to call them the Shakespeares of comics, you know, Morrison's, Gaiman, and more. What, you know, what brought you to the point where you're like, this is something I want, you know, you have a non-prose degree. You know, you went into the sciences, and you're just like, you know what? I don't want to design anything anymore. I want to write. Like, where did that switch happen, or why did it happen?
I mean, I actually worked as a chemical engineer for about 6 years. And I traveled a lot during that time. So I had always been writing. Writing had always been a hobby of mine. Even when I was working, I used to write in, like, lunch breaks and on airplanes and empty hotel rooms. And so traveling, I think, was a huge catalyst in me wanting to write, or sort of spurring on my creativity. So
it was something
once I started...
Something to fill the time? That's why you're saying you were drawn to writing at that point? Or was it something to help get you off the road and staying in a constant place?
No, I think it was just... when you for me, when I travel... I'm always amazed by how varied the world is, but also by how similar things are. Like, I've lived in Mumbai, I've lived in New York, I'm living in London now. And they're all such incredibly different and varied and vibrant cities, but, you know, people want the same things. People are afraid of the same thing. They're trying to achieve the same things no matter where you go. And so that aspect of it really was inspiring to me in terms of the stories I wrote. So a lot of the stories that I do, even with my first comic, was actually about translating that kind of a multicultural experience, if you will, because my first comic was a book called Black Mumba, which I did, and I self-published that. And that was basically 1940s American crime noir, but set in Mumbai. And there were no actual crimes in any of the stories. It was just this weird black and white lens of looking at this strange city. And what was really sort of interesting for me was when people who read it came to me and said, you know, I didn't know anything about Mumbai, but knowing everything about American crime noir, it acted as this, like, really familiar and comfortable gateway for me to look at the city that you're trying to present. And so that kind of stuff was really inspirational to me, and that what spurred on writing. And then 2011 came around, or 2012 came around, and, you know, I had had a few things published here and there in terms of short stories. And at the end of the year, I wasn't really enjoying doing the chemical engineering work. And I realized that I was really traveling because I enjoyed traveling, not because I enjoyed the work. So at that point, I said, you know what, I'm going to take a risk. I've had a few things published, so I feel like I can do this. I'm going to start writing. And I really just quit my old job and jumped both feet in. And I didn't know at that point what was going to happen, if I was going to be okay or not. But here I am, you know, like three or four years later, I had the nod from Image for Paradiso. So that was quite a big step for me.
Yeah, tell us about Paradiso for those who aren't familiar with it.
So Paradiso is this post-apocalyptic dystopian sci-fi story about a group of adventurers going through the last surviving city on the planet. But the twist is that the city is alive and sentient, and has its own whims and fancies. So that's the general premise, and the plot kind of starts when one of our protagonists arrives at the border to the city with a device known as the Numus, which is capable of bringing dead technology back to life.
That's cool. No.
I feel like I've stunned everybody with that.
Sometimes we look at each other and we're not sure. Like, we're trying to be polite to see who wants to ask the next question. Yeah. So, yeah. And then there you go. So,
yeah. So,
typical,
I mean,
Midwesterners.
So, yeah. So you collaborate. Well, your main collaborator on that book is Dev. He's the artist. He's based in India. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So Dave's one of the artists that collaborated with me on Black Mamba, which was a self-published book that I talked about. And so we had worked together on that book before. And then once I'd sort of finished self-publishing that book, it had opened up a lot of sort of doorways for me. I'd started talking to Eric Stephenson at Image, a couple of other editors. And so we decided, you know, let's make this book, let's make the first few pages and pitch it. And I had the opportunity to pitch it at Thought Bubble here in Leeds. And Eric liked it and he said, yeah, let me know when you guys have full issues completed.
Excellent. Yeah. So how many times have you been to Thought Bubble? Because I have to admit, I don't know whether I told you this when I met you, but I lived in Leeds for 10 years and I never went to Thought Bubble. And I don't know why. Either I was too tired at the weekend, or I just I don't know. But I've heard it's an amazing.
It is a really good convention. I kind of think of it, even though I'm in London, I kind of think of it as my home convention, yeah, if you will. I really love that con. The first time I went was 2015, I think.
Okay.
And I really had no work published by then. I was just going as a sort of punter, if you will.
Yeah.
And I had a chance to meet a bunch of creators, and I had just started maybe like four pages of incomplete art at that point, and I was just showing it around, and I found most of the creators there so encouraging. I remember standing by Christian Ward's table, showing him the first few pages of Black Mamba.
Yeah.
And then fast forward 2 years later, Christian did the variant cover for the first issue of Paradiso.
That's right. Yes. Excellent.
So that's what Thought Bubble kind of means to me. Yeah. I've been going there every year, and it's become this kind of examination for me, because I share my progress with all of these established creators there every year when I go now. So.
Excellent. I mean, I enjoyed the story very much, and I'm looking forward to the fifth issue. The first trade is now out, and it collects the first four issues. We have it in stock now, $9.99. Nice plug there. So I'm looking forward to the next arc, which actually begins on the 4th of July, I believe. Issue 5 is coming out, and some of my favorite scenes. I mean, I'm a bit of a car guy. I mean, don't ask me models or like anything about the engines, just the aesthetics of cars. So any vehicle that Dev draws, I'm like that. I would buy that page, you know.
you're gonna have a lot of fun with the second arc, because this is how I do my short descriptions. If you think of Arc 1 as kind of Mad Max meets Westworld kind of vibe, then Arc 2 is a Tron meets space vampires kind of vibe.
Okay, wow.
So there's lots of like weird lighting and bikes going through these kind of laser.
Amazing. That sounds awesome. Sounds awesome. So as you with the collaboration with Dev, you know, in terms of like the designs of the characters and things, you know, is it like an equal split? Do you suggest? I wanted to backtrack because I know you draw, because I've seen you post images on Twitter. So do you do like sketches of things, or is it all descriptions and Dev comes up with the actual visuals?
Sometimes. I mean, I work really closely with these guys. They're more sort of friends than super professional relationships.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, I can't do that with every collaborator that I meet. But when that does happen, it kind of all goes for a toss if you have these rules about, you know, who does what. So I guess there is an equal split, if you will. So there are definitely characters. I went to him and I said, this is what I want them to look like.
Yeah.
This is my design. I just want you to do this. And then he would come back and they would have all these changes. And I would look at them and go, yeah, that does look better, Dave. Let's just go with that. Yeah. So, and then there were times where, you know, he had a design idea for a character, came back to me and said, can we work this one into the story somehow? And then I would have to go back and sort of retrofit the story with this new design for a character. So I find that to be like the most entertaining aspect of making comics with your friends.
Yeah, definitely.
Now you've got the two top titles we've talked about are pretty disparate in their settings and tone and everything like that. So, like, where does the inspiration for Paradiso come from? Is it something that's floated for a long time versus, like, you know, like you're doing 1940s noir and now you're doing crazy science fiction? You know, like where do you get those ideas from?
In general, I think everyone has ideas. The only difference between a writer and someone who's not a writer is that the writer is crazy enough to go, yeah, I can make something out of this and sell this. So everyone has crazy ideas, but I think it's a matter of kind of following up on that initial spur of an idea that you have and then having the patience and imagination and really disciplined to sit down and expand it into a story, because a story is a lot harder to write than an idea. So I mean, on a general level, I think that's where ideas come from. It's just people going, what if, or you look at something and you go, huh, that looked like something else to me for a moment. Like, I remember, I think it was Scott Snyder talking about it, where he went, you know, he used to go down into this forest when he was a kid, and he looked at trees, and sometimes they looked like people were hanging out of them. And that's where the idea for witches came from, apparently. So everyone has these ideas. But specifically, Paradiso came up because when I was living in the States, I studied in Philadelphia, and at the time, UPenn had a really successful architecture school, so I had a lot of friends who were architects. And one of these friends is someone who had a really active interest in writing and comics and art. And we were really close. So if you look at Paradise, if you look at the trade, it actually says created by Ram V, Dave Pramanik, and Rajiv Bhagat. So Rajiv is actually an architect and an urban designer, and we've been friends for over a decade now. And the original idea was just the two of us sitting down over drinks one night going, you know what, we should do stories that are set inside an actual living city. And that's kind of where it started from. We wrote short stories that were set inside this living city way before I had sort of decided to start writing comics. So it's kind of been floating around for 5 or 6 years, give or take.
Excellent. I'm going to piggyback on that just a little bit, Rich, because I was thinking the same thing. Also bringing in Ruin of Thieves, which is another vastly different book in terms of genre. Just listening to you talk about your love of travel, it almost seems like that's what you're doing with your books here. It's like, oh, let's visit this place, and we're also going to visit this place, in terms of this one's the sci-fi dystopian, this one is medieval fantasy, and and so do you find I know we got into Paradiso a little bit there, but is there anything in your travels and whatnot that you find pulls into the books and the things you write?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you look at Rune of Thieves, in fact, something I really pride myself on is a lot of the fantasy books kind of go back to the same sort of medieval European setting. And so you find a lot of books that are either taking from like Norse mythology or have to do with Vikings or have to do with the Dark Ages. But no one really seems to investigate similar periods in different settings. So Rune of Thieves really has a more sort of desert Middle Eastern vibe combined with the old school sort of European Dark Ages vibe. And I feel like that comes from traveling. And the other thing that traveling really helps with in terms of jumping genres is you realize no matter what genre you're in, the fundamental of part of what makes a story good is that the human experience is universal. You could be reading a sci-fi story or you could be reading a fantasy story. In the end, the things you care about are the same. You still want, you know, the characters that you care about to have catharsis, or you still want to experience the same things from these different stories. So as a writer, obviously, to be conversant with the genre is important, but also just to realize that the fundamental part of a story that you're getting to is just the human experience, and that you experience each time you travel to a country where you don't know anyone and you still end up making friends, or you still end up knowing how to communicate with people, and you realize that, oh yeah, okay, we have different words but for the same thing, you know?
Yeah, you can have the most high-concept idea, but if you don't have characters that anyone cares about, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's when, you know, you have a story that's just an idea, and you don't really have a story. An idea, I mean, lots of people have these fantastic premises, but the hard part is populating those with characters that people will invest in and will want to go back to time and again.
Yep.
I wanted to ask, I mean, we've talked about a couple of your projects. Have you got anything new that you can talk about that you kind of is in the works at the moment?
Well, one thing that was kind of recently announced is I've got a book called These Savage Shores that will come out with Vault at the end of the year, and I'm just finishing up a graphic novel called Graffiti's Wall, which is with a book publisher called Unbound, based in the UK, okay, which should also be out around September. So These Savage Shores is set in pre-colonial sort of 1760s in India, and it's about vampirism and colonialism and local legends and all of that sort of set into this political hotspot that India used to be in that time and age. Okay. So it's a very interesting book for me to write. It takes a lot from Stoker's Dracula, but it also could be looked at as alt history, and I'm very excited about that book. Graffiti's Wall is a more personal kind of less genre book, if you will, because it's just about four kids growing up on the streets in Mumbai. So I always kind of explain it as Train Spotting, but set in crazy Mumbai.
Cool.
Those sound excellent. I mean, yeah, that's something I always think about too, is, you know, like, it's hard to make money as a comic writer, right? I mean, is that... you got to be doing it because you need to do it, you know, first and foremost. But, you know, would you work for Marvel or DC down the line? Would you hope that, you know, something gets picked up by a movie company? I mean, that's the era we're in, right? So,
I've been talking to both the big two publishers, and I potentially will have work coming out somewhere around end of the year, maybe early next year, with them. But nothing I can actually talk about.
Oh, yeah.
Black Mumba, which was the first book that I did, is actually being sort of looked at in terms of turning that into a TV show in India for Netflix or Amazon or one of these streaming sort of outlets. So, but none of these things are things that I started out and I went, that's what I want to do. That's where I want to go. I think the success is the stuff that happens to you while you're focused on just doing good work. If you kind of end up chasing the success, and don't get me wrong, you have to do all the right things. You have to network. You have to put yourself out there and talk to people. All of those things are important. But I'm not a particularly sort of charismatic guy when it comes to talking to editors and stuff like that. So I prefer that my work do most of the talking for me. So when I self-published Black Mamba, the first thing I did was I sent it out to all of these editors, and that's what kind of opened up doors for me. So yes, the success happens if you do good work, but you can't be chasing that. I think you're very right in saying that you have to do it because you love doing it.
Yeah, that's one thing that we find a lot as we've begun talking to more creators and professionals in these fields, is that the people who are successful are the ones that just love doing it and work hard doing it. And, you know, that opportunity tends to find them as they're working hard doing what they love.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is not particularly different in any other walk of life. Even if you go to architecture or chemical engineering, you'll find that the really successful people are just successful because they love doing the work. And when the industry finds people like that, they tend to sort of shower opportunities on those people. So as long as I'm getting nods and looks in from editors, I feel like I'm doing the right things. So hopefully it'll lead somewhere.
We talked in the last podcast, we had Keith Baker, who's a game designer, on and did a lot of writing leading up to that. And the difference isn't, everybody's got crazy ideas. The difference is you do them. You know, you actually, and I'm a big follower of, I love J. Michael Straczynski. I love to listen to him talk about writing and being creative. And, I mean, there's no other lesson than write all the time. Don't worry about whether it's good, bad. That is irrelevant. Just write, you know. And it seems to me more and more that, you know, the people who are successful and the people who aren't, that's the difference. It isn't always, I mean, people have talent. I'm not dismissing that, but it is the talent is doing it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, at some point, if you don't have any aptitude or talent for something, if you've done it long enough, you will come to that realization yourself. But that's not where most people stumble. Most people stumble in just not having the discipline to sit down and do it. I've met so many people who I've spoken to about sort of jumping from chemical engineering to writing. And one thing I always hear is, oh yeah, you know, I've always wanted to write too, which is true, which is so true of so many people, that, cause it's not hard, right? It's not difficult putting down words on paper, but having the discipline to do it day in and day out, and having that mindset that goes, you know, okay, on Monday you might be inspired, on Tuesday you might not feel like sitting down and writing at all, but if you're going to be a professional and if you're going to do it, and if it's going to be the way that you earn a living out of it, then you have to be able to write even when you're not inspired, not particularly up to sitting down in front of a computer screen, but you have to find your way of tricking yourself into getting into that mindset where you're ready to sit down and do something interesting and creative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is fascinating to, on the one hand, know that you have to do art for the sake of doing that art, but on the other hand, know that you have to do it commercially in order to make money, and figure out, you know, how those two things mesh for you as a creator.
You know, I always quote Meryl Streep when it comes to that. So apparently she was being interviewed and someone said, you know, you're such an incredibly talented, gifted actress, and you come onto these roles and you always win awards for all of them. How do you do it? And she said, it's the craft more than the talent, because the talent will shine through on the days that you're inspired and on the days that everything comes easy. But it's when that doesn't happen that you have to rely on craft. And she says, you know, most professionals rely on craft. And then you get those moments of brilliance when, you know, forces conspire to give you inspiration and give you that moment of brilliance. But a lot of what you see is just people being very good at their craft. And that comes with discipline and practice and time.
I'm going to ask everybody for one last question, but I have a really good friend at DC Comics on the sales team, Stuart Schreck, and we were talking about books during the New 52. He used to have to call retail shops every week, poor Stu, and but that's how we became really good friends. But anyway, you know, one day I was talking about some book that was it was just terrible, and he said, this is one of my favorite quotes, "No one tries to make a bad comic."
Yeah.
And, I mean, I don't know, I wish I had a poster that said that on it.
So. The kid hanging from a tree or something.
Yeah, Brad, any last questions, Brad?
Since you're relatively new into comics, I mean, your bibliography isn't that long. Have you had that moment, like you've had, Darren is one, you've had people that have asked for signatures and other stuff. Have you had anybody cosplay one of your characters yet? And cosplay it to the point where you know it's your character without asking them who they're cosplaying. Have you had that happen yet? Because if not, I think Mr. Honeybad could be very well done if someone wanted to put the time into it.
Yeah, I agree. but actually, my first ever comic was I did a series called Akori in India, which was this kind of weird sort of Indian John Constantine, if you will. Except he dresses really weirdly and has these like sort of massive dreadlocks and beard and stuff like that. And that character gets cosplayed all the time, especially at conventions back in India. So nice. it was strange to see that happen, but I was like, okay, that's pretty cool that people are cosplaying a character from a comic.
Mm-hmm. Joshua.
All right, so... I always think this is a fun question to ask because I think it reveals a lot about a person, but who would you most like to collaborate with on a comic book? Like, what other artist or whomever?
I mean, this changes a lot from time to time. Mm-hmm. So, at the moment, given the kind of work that I'm seeing, I would love to work with Tom Coker because... I love Black Monday Murders. I love the kind of stark noir art that he's doing. But if you go back and look at all the comics I've ever read, and if I had to give you names from there, I'd probably say Dave McKean and Mike Mignola. Yeah.
Oh, I am a big Dave McKean fan. I love his artwork. Oh my gosh, yeah.
Well, you know, they listen to this podcast, so maybe they'll hear.
Yeah, actually, when I first moved to London. I had a chance to go see Dave McKean performing his sort of Nine Lives thing that he'd put together, like a animation and art and music for. So I did have the chance to meet with him, which was kind of cool. Wow. And I've also met Mike when he'd come down to Thought Bubble. So I've met both of these people, so it's not like I'm just a complete stranger going, oh yeah, I'd love to collaborate.
No. I actually don't have any questions. I mean, I just wanted to thank you so very much for coming on. And, you know, I keep going on about the time difference, but, you know, you talked about the discipline of writing and do you work every day until 2 a.m. writing? Is that your...
Yeah, I have two sort of writing slots set down. I write from about 11 in the morning to about 3 in the afternoon. I take a break. I read in the evening, you know, wife comes home, we have dinner, we go out. And then I sit down about 10 or 11 at night, and I usually write till about 2:30.
Wow. I see. That's the discipline.
There you go.
Absolutely.
We're going to ask you for some contact info, how people can find you and all that. But, yeah, my last question just sort of goes back to we're at a point in time when we're blessed and cursed. We have more opportunity than ever before in human history to get our stuff out there if we wanted to write, if we want whatever we wanted to do. The curse is that there's so many people getting their stuff out there. You know, do you worry about that? Like, or do you just got to do your work? You know, like, what do you think of, like, I guess the question is, there are infinite comics sitting in the stands today. Like,
yes.
What do you do to get Paradiso out there, or do you just not worry about that?
I mean, to an extent, I feel like you have to do whatever you can do. So I did put in a lot of work into sort of contacting news websites, going out on Twitter, calling up retailers, talking to them. So I did all of those things. But that has to be separate from your sort of motivation and desire to create. So when I'm creating something, I don't worry about whether it's going to be successful, whether it's going to be looked at. Rather, what I worry about when I'm doing that is this something that will stand out on its own? So I guess that's the more important question to ask, because you're absolutely right. Writing and creating art has become like a much more democratized process where anyone and everyone who wants to write or create art can do it and can put their work out, which is great. So if you're going to be someone that you want people to take notice of, then you have to ask yourself, what can I do that is uniquely me? So I don't think anyone's done a crime noir book set in Mumbai with no crime in it. You know what I mean? So if you're gonna have an idea and you're just gonna be doing, you know, another version of some sort of heist story, or if you're just gonna be doing another superhero book, then you have to ask yourself, what am I putting in here that is uniquely me? And I think the answer to that question will guide any creator to creating work that stands out. Like, you have so many artists all creating work, but you can look at, you know, someone like Jason Latour's work and go immediately recognize that, yeah, that's Jason Latour's art. Or you can look at, you know, Mike McDonald's art and immediately recognize that that's Mike. And I think that comes from knowing what you can bring to the medium rather than just trying to create something that's part of that medium. So even as people who are new to comics or new to art or new to writing, you should always be asking the question, why is this me? Why can nobody else do this?
Oh, that's awesome. That's a close right there. I'm not going to ask another question. So. Josh, you want to get info and all that jazz?
Yes, absolutely. Ram, tell us where people can find you out in the world and on the internet and wherever else.
Yeah. So I'm on Facebook as Ram Venkatesan, which is hard to spell. But if you search for Ram V, you'll find me. I'm on Twitter as at the right Ram, as opposed to the wrong one. So you can find me on Twitter there. Those are two of my most sort of used social medias. I can only do that much. Anything more than that, and I'll go crazy. I'll be staring at a screen for too long.
Yeah. Yep, I feel Amen. The same way. Excellent. Well, in terms of Paradox and the DoxCast, you can check us out at paradoxcnc.com. The DoxCast does go up every Monday morning on iTunes, unless I mess up and don't get it up in time. But we're on there, and we do these podcasting sessions live roughly once a month. So tune in, check us out on Facebook at paradoxcnc. At paradoxcnc on Twitter. And you'll get updates on when we're going live and all that good stuff as well. We're, of course, on twitch.tv at ParadoxCNC. So find us on all those places. Stop in at the store. Get Paradiso. Get Ruin of Thieves. Grab those books. Someone who is viewing us on Facebook has already said they're going to get a copy of Paradiso. So
nice
work, awesome. Everybody. We
Yay.
Sold one.
Well, that, you know, yeah. So we want to be a conduit for you. Like, I hope you get more out of this podcast than we do. We want to help you become a better creator, sell more books, all those sorts of things. That's the most value we can give to you. And we want to help customers A, we want to help customers find something they're going to love, and B, we want to reach one person who was inspired by what Ram V had to say. I mean, this is a great podcast. You know, I think you said so many very fascinating things, and we've run into that time and time and time again. We've done 220 plus episodes of the show, and the first nearly 200 was just us talking to each other. And we finally were like, this is, you know, we had 30 listeners, you know, and we still have about 30 listeners, but you know, but the thing is, we've changed. We've turned a corner. You know, we're trying to bring what we're good at to the table, but to get you an outlet, and hopefully we can keep working to make this better and figure out how to reach 30,000 people and so on and so forth. So, but great interviews like this are certainly a good start. So,
yeah, it's great to be on here, and it's absolutely my pleasure to be on here, talk to you guys, talk to your customers, and talk to just people generally interested in creating things. It's always been a passion for me, and I'll always be available to talk to anyone. So,
yeah, I've been
pretty approachable guy.
I've been in retail for 25 years, but I do think you know, it's my creative side that's driven most of that, and it's a successful 25 years. But I mean, I'm not a businessman, and so, you know, for me, my heart just sings when I come up with some goofy event and it works, you know, and so it's that wannabe writer in me, you know, that drives all that. So, but yeah, thanks a lot. We will get a hold of you when this goes up. We record 3 or 4 at a shot, and so I don't know which week what goes up. Sometimes we try to
probably
it to
do it in conjunction with the next issue.
Yeah. Rune of Thieves.
Paradiso. Okay. So that'll be the week of the 4th of July. It'll be the
there
Monday. So what, the 2nd of
cool.
July?
Yep.
Yeah.
Perfect. You're only competing with the Batman wedding that day, so no problem.
I've actually got both Rune of Thieves and Paradiso dropping on that day. And,
oh, that's awesome.
I was talking to retailers here, and they're like, oh, yeah, it's only Batman wedding, Batman 50
yeah.
coming out.
Yeah.
Oh, man. That's tough.
Yeah, so. Well, here it's tough. Here we're in Lakes Country. Like, this town empties. Like, we don't even know if we're gonna sell a copy of Batman Wedding on the 4th of July, because there's no one here. You know, like, Fargo's a town that loves to be the cool place, and even the town just doesn't do anything because, like, it's gone. There's no one here. So, but we're trying. We came up with we called it Nerd Dependence Day, and you know, we're just throwing stuff at the wall, from board gaming to Magic to Batman Wedding to Captain America, or whatever we can think of to try to get people in the door. So
I wish I was there. I'm not doing anything here on the 4th of July. I'd definitely come down for that.
Oh, you're welcome. You're yeah. certainly I'll put you on the guest list. All right,
thank you, Ram. Thank you very much.
Thank you guys. Thanks for
yeah, thanks
me.
A lot.
And thanks to all of our listeners, whether you're listening live or checking us out later. We will see you on the next DoxCast.
This was a DoxCast. Hope you think it rocks cast. Oh, look at the clocks cast. Until next time, be gone.